From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Christian apologist Abdu Murray, author of Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that takes me out of the studio into the study where I have the opportunity to talk to some of the most informative, interesting, intelligent, inspirational people on the planet. And today I get to do that with Abdu Murray. He's North American director with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He's an author of some very, very significant books, including his latest, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. Abdu is an attorney. He's been named several times in Best Lawyers in America and Michigan Super Lawyer. And about his latest book, I said that Saving Truth is powerfully poignant in an age in which internet fabrications travel halfway around the world before truth has had the chance to put its boots on. There is no greater need in a post-truth culture of confusion than clarity respecting truth. What it is, how one can know it, and most importantly, why we must submit our personal preferences to it, no matter the cost. By the way, Abdu has also written some other books I want to talk about today. Grand Central Question, subtitled Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews, a very important work, and Apocalypse Later, which is perhaps my favorite, Why the Gospel of Peace Must Trump the Politics of Prophecy in the Middle East. Abdu, it's great to have you on Hank Unplugged.
It's an honor to be on Hank Unplugged. Hank, thanks so much for having me.
You know, the last book I talked about, I think this is interesting in that as I was rereading this book the other day, I noticed that in some ways, the eschatology so popular in modern-day Christianity can be a barrier to conversion. And I know that my book, The Apocalypse Code, has been translated into Arabic, circulated all over the Arab world. And when people read it, they so often recognize that oftentimes the caricature is not the same as the real. In other words, so often people look at a caricature of Christianity or a caricature of the God of the Bible as opposed to seeing the real God of the Bible. And I noticed that this had become a stumbling block as you were finding your way to Christ.
That's right. In fact, coming from a Muslim background and with a Lebanese heritage, and I was coming to faith right around the time of the Y2K bug, furor and all that. And everyone was talking about the end of the world and the future, and eschatology was a big thing, and apocalypse was a word on everyone's lips all the time. And so I had seen the depth of the evidence for the Christian faith, both the reliability of the New Testament as the book itself, but also the Old, and the facts surrounding Jesus' resurrection. Your ministry played no small part in that, by the way. So I was hearing all that and seeing the credibility of it, but then hearing also sort of the loudest voices talk about one aspect of one part of the debate of, you know, the end of the world and all this thing. And you heard a lot of people talking about certain people being favored over other people, basically because of DNA. And I remember thinking to myself, if I hear this discussion about God being this God of love and loves humanity and all these things, but he seems to love certain parts of humanity more than other parts, and largely based on this eschatological issue. So that was a stumbling block for me, and it kept me it didn't keep me from the faith completely, but I'll tell you, it did retard my progress, because I really had to wrestle with some of those issues more than I otherwise would have been. And in fact, I think I put in the book a section called Stumbling Over the Right Block. The gospel is a stumbling block, and all by itself, we don't need to put more in the way of people. If you want them to stumble, have them stumble over the right thing. I thankfully was able to get past some of those issues. In writing the book, my goal wasn't to necessarily pick a specific view on end times eschatology, so much as present that really intelligent, well-informed, Bible-believing people have differing views, but this shouldn't be the message, the only message that non-Christians hear. They need to hear the gospel itself.
Yeah, so again, the subtitle is so important, Why the Gospel of Peace Must Trump the Politics of Prophecy in the Middle East. I mean, there's first things first, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there are lots of Christians who are very, very dear friends of mine who are Christian Zionists, dispensationalists. I vehemently disagree with them, but I think your point is simply to say that let's not put stumbling blocks in front of people so that they're inhibited from coming to faith in Jesus Christ. And it must have been a great relief for you to recognize that God is not a racist and he is not a land broker.
Absolutely. I think that was a fundamental transformation in my understanding of who the God of the Bible actually is. In distinction, in fact, I would say, to God as I understood him in Islam, with Muslims being, you know, considered the best of peoples and a superior in their belief systems because of their heritage. And so the gospel's universality and God's love for all people, regardless of who they are and what ethnicity they might bear, was actually a welcomed relief. And thank goodness that I was able to get past some of the sort of the, I wouldn't call it tribalism, but it's at least a pseudo-tribalism that I was seeing in some American evangelicalism, which I was also happy to see wasn't the only expression of Western evangelicalism. And essentially, I was able to see my way to the gospel specifically, and then I could deal with those other issues. And they're worthy of our debate. You wrote a whole book about it because it's a worthy discussion. And I think that it is worthy. But it's not something that everybody should be hearing only or exclusively.
Yeah, I think that's right. Talk about your conversion to Christ. I think your story is so incredibly interesting in that here you are, a Muslim, a Shia Muslim, and your background is Lebanon, and now you are somehow or other going on a trek. You're following truth wherever it leads. That trek is leading you towards Christianity. It's a long process. Let's have a little glimpse of what's going on.
Sure, yeah. So because I was pretty serious about Islam, you know, I wouldn't buy into this whole, if it's true for you, it's true for you. If it's true for me, it's true for me, even if they contradict. I wouldn't buy into any of that. I thought Islam was true, and it didn't matter if you believed it or not. It was true regardless of your positions or preferences. So I was trying to convince people that Islam was true. And I was trying to do it in the most genteel and conversational way I possibly could, and I was pretty good at it. But along the way, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to the mosque, as they say. I encountered some Christians who actually knew what they were talking about, but they were a scant few, unfortunately. I'll tell you this. Most of the time when I would engage with Christians in conversations, I'd ask them a question, some form of this question at some point. Why are you a Christian? And I would ask this of anybody, whether they were, you know, Hindus or Buddhists or Jews or atheists. I'd ask, why are you what you are? What's the foundation for that? But because Christians, especially nominal Christians, were sort of low-hanging fruit in the area I grew up in, I would ask people who would claim to be Christians that question, why are you a Christian? And oftentimes, the answer was tradition. I was supposed to be. I was raised that way. Or they'd even answer me in the form of a question. They'd say, well, I go to the Presbyterian church on Christmas and Easter, so I guess I'm a Presbyterian? And they would actually answer that way. And I'm like, are you sure? So they would say, tradition. And I would say, not good enough. You can't trust your eternal soul to a worldview someone else believes without thinking it through yourself. So I would begin to fill the vacuum of their belief with the credibility of Islam. Well, two guys came to my door while I was an undergraduate at University of Michigan, two Baptist guys, and they said, we want to talk about Jesus with you. And I was like, oh, amazing. You guys deliver. This is great. So I invited these two guys into my into our apartment, and I made them uncomfortable for quite some time, just challenging their beliefs and all this, but they kept coming back over and over again. And sometimes they had answers, sometimes they didn't have answers, and sometimes their answers were just, I don't know, but I'll get back to you. And then they did. And it was that started this journey for me, where I began to see some things that I didn't ordinarily see. I was trying to poke a hole in the Bible to try to find a fundamental contradiction that they couldn't get past. So I had this little green Bible from the Gideons, and I was holding on to this thing, and I was reading it, waiting for these guys to come back to my apartment. And I came across Luke chapter 3, verses 7 and following, and you know, paraphrasing it. John the Baptist is baptizing people, and he says, "You brood of vipers, who told you to flee from the wrath to come?" Of course, referring to God's judgment. And then he says, "Do not even begin to think to yourself you have Abraham as your father. For I tell you, God can raise up children of Abraham from the stones." Basically, he's saying, your tradition's not going to save you. Truth saves you. I found myself fascinated by the fact that John the Baptist, 2,000 years ago, in a book that I thought at that time was corrupted, was asking people the same question I was asking. Why are you what you are? And they were saying tradition, and he was saying not good enough. That's what I was saying. And what the most remarkable thing to me was that the Bible, through the words of the Bible, through John the Baptist's words, born aloft by the Holy Spirit for 20 centuries, asked me what no other Christian had asked me: why are you a Muslim? And the answer was tradition. And I had had plenty of reasons to be and arguments in my head, but the real reason was because I was raised that way and I was supposed to be that way. Well, that started the journey where I thought to myself, I'm going to follow truth, not because of tradition, but because of truth. I was fully confident Islam was true, but I was going to put it to the test along with everything else. And along the way, the veracity of the scriptures, not only the reliability of transmission, but also that they actually conform to actual history and actual reality, the philosophy of scripture, all these things started really speaking to me. And essentially what ended up happening over a 9-year journey, the things that I was hoping was true in Islam, you know, the phrase Allahu Akbar, you know, Muslims say this all over the world, as you well know, it means God is greater. It literally means God is bigger, but the connotation is God is greater. God is the greatest possible being. Well, it struck me towards the end of this journey that if God was the greatest possible being, then he would necessarily express the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. And the greatest ethic is love, and the greatest way to express it is self-sacrifice. So if God is truly great, he would be the God that you find in Scripture, in the Bible, the God who is the greatest being, who sacrifices himself in the greatest expression of love possible. And Romans chapter 5, verse 8, I remember where I was when I read it. For God demonstrates his love for us, and that while we were sinners, Christ died for us. The greatest possible being expressing the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. And that's when I realized the God I'm looking for, the only God there is the God of the Scriptures.
So this is sort of an incredible trek intellectually, understanding that the God of the Bible is the real God of the universe. But I wonder what it's like for you from an emotional standpoint, because the closer you get for Jesus Christ to become Savior and Lord of your life, the more difficult it gets with respect to your own family, I would imagine, for the whole nucleus of support that you've had all your life now is going to disappear. Talk about the emotion of something like that.
Well, in the second book, Grand Central Question, the very first chapter of the book is about the idea of the personal cost of truth and how people often say they want truth, but the reality is they want comfort. And they'll tell themselves certain things are true in order to sort of satisfy that desire for comfort. Without going into too much detail, because obviously it's a very personal part of the story for me and for other people that I'm close to, it was obviously a very tough thing for everyone, not just for me, but for those who loved me and the things that they would go through. And I didn't want to put them through tough things, let alone myself. But it wasn't. That's why it took 9 years. I often put it this way. It took 9 years, not because the truth was hard to find. It's because the truth was hard to accept. And that's true for so many people. Coming from the background I come from, not only religiously but culturally, you just don't change those things. And if you do, it's catastrophic relationships can be severed. But fundamentally, and the good news is that my relationships are strong. They're strong, once again. But you worry about that stuff. And countless people I've met, whether they're Muslims or Hindus or Jews or whatever it is, when they come to Christ, there's a price to pay. For me, one of the most important ones was identity. Who the heck would I be after this? I liked being a Muslim. I was happy being one. I was proud of being one. Who would I be at the end of the day? You know, it's funny. A really famous Jewish guy said 2,000 years ago, you said, die to yourself. I felt like I couldn't be intellectually honest, but also even honest to a faithful degree spiritually, and not be willing to do that. And I think that barrier is really big, whether it's for a Muslim or anybody else. The intellectual objections are real, and they have to be taken seriously. But I often find, as with my own case, I found that sometimes the intellectual barriers are as much of a smokescreen to the emotional barriers as anything can be. So we have to address them honestly, but recognize that no one's Mr. Spock. Everyone has reasons to accept or reject beliefs that have nothing to do with the merits of that belief, but often have to do with the consequences.
I love that phrase, truth is not all that hard to find, but it is hard to accept. So there's a sense in which you want to live with a motivated blindness. In other words, you're not going into the situation as a doctor with a white lab coat on where you have no biases. You do have biases, and you want to confirm your biases.
Absolutely, and that's a part of the human condition.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and Christian apologist Abdu Murray. There is no greater need in our post-truth culture of confusion than the clarification of truth, what truth is, how one can know truth, and most importantly, why we must submit our personal preferences to truth, no matter the cost. Be sure to read Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World by Abdu Murray. To receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. The history of Islam is one of wanton carnage and horrific oppression, and it has been whitewashed beyond recognition by our politically correct elites. According to credible sources, 120 million Africans, 80 million Hindus, 60 million Christians, 10 million Buddhists have been slaughtered in the name of Islam. And that doesn't include the millions of Muslims killed by other Muslims. Islam is the only significant religious system in the history of the human race with a socio-political structure of laws that mandate violence against the infidel. Read Hank Hanegraaff's stunning book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. Receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership when you call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Many feminists see the warped value system portrayed in Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale as a reflection of Christian and social conservative ideologies. In reality, the dominant secular worldview, with its idolization of sexual freedom and rejection of intrinsic human dignity, fosters in the actual world the very oppression seen in the series. Other topics include how the structure and comprehensibility of the universe reveal a mindful maker, five apologetics lessons from the writings of Martin Luther King Jr., kindergartners need apologetics too, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Increasingly, Western culture embraces confusion as a virtue and decries certainty as a sin. Those who are confused about sexuality and identity are viewed as heroes. Those who are confused about morality are progressive pioneers. Conversely, those who express certainty about any of these issues are seen as bigoted and intolerant. In Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World, Abdu Murray responds to the confusion by offering gospel clarity that can touch the hearts and minds of those in our post-truth culture. To receive your copy of Saving Truth as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and his guest Abdu Murray in their conversation on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
I love that phrase, truth is not all that hard to find, but it is hard to accept. So there's a sense in which you want to live with a motivated blindness. In other words, you're not going into the situation as a doctor with a white lab coat on where you have no biases. You do have biases and you want to confirm your biases.
Absolutely, and that's a part of the human condition. And all of us have that. And I would even say it applies to us even when we're believers. There are interdenominational or, our views on whether it's the eschatology or whether it's on baptism, whatever it is, we hold on to these things. C.S. Lewis made that comment, I think it was in the early parts of Mere Christianity, talking about different denominations. I think he said, we often go with what's comfortable or what's traditional. He said, if you look for truth, you will find comfort. But if you look for comfort, you will get neither truth nor comfort. Only soft soap to begin with, but in the end, despair. And yes, we look for comfort first, but we're not going to get it without truth.
That's why your book, Saving Truth, is so transcendently important. It's again subtitled Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. And there's probably very few words that better describe the spirit of the age in which we live than the word that you use so often in this book, post-truth. We're so familiar with the moniker postmodernism, but you're saying that post-truth is probably a more relevant moniker for our times.
Yeah, indeed. I think we're actually seeing the death of postmodernism, and what's arising sort of from the carcass, as it were, is the spirit of post-truth. In 2016, Oxford English Dictionary's named post-truth as its word of the year. And the word of the year is simply a word that captures the ethos and pathos of what's happening in the culture at that time. And how they define it is something is post-truth if it is relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. It's just a fancy way of saying feelings and preferences matter more than facts and truth. Now, that's different than postmodernism, as you all know and you've spoken so well about. Postmodernism is the idea of relative truths, and it denies the objectivity of truth. So my truth is my truth, your truth. Any attempt to foist on me an objective truth is really a power move, but it's an illegitimate one because there's no such thing as objective truth. But someone like that, who's a postmodern, you can actually begin to, strangely enough, reason with someone like that because you can ask them the question, as so many people have heard, is it objectively true that there are no objective truths? And of course, if it is objectively true, well, then there are objective truths, and in which case the whole thing is self-defeating. I think people have started to realize that. And so post-truth, unlike postmodernism says there is no objective truth. Post-truth says there is an objective truth, but I don't care. And that's a little bit harder to deal with, isn't it? Because now, if you use reason and logic, they're saying, yeah, but my preferences are against what you just said, so I don't care. And that's a little more difficult to deal with.
How does that affect the whole discipline of apologetics today?
Well, profoundly. Because if I were to sit there and talk to somebody and say, okay, someone says, well, why are you a Christian? And I were to say the resurrection of Jesus as the linchpin fact of human history, of all of history, which of course is true. And as you know, Paul says, if he's not raised, then the whole thing is basically in vain. It is the falsifiable and verifiable fact of history. And I were to tell them all the evidence for that. But they recognize that if I were to believe that, then I have to change my preferences. Let's say it's a lifestyle. Let's say it's romantic attachments. Let's just say it's a hedonistic lifestyle. And they say, yeah, but my preferences are that I live this way. So you can tell me all that, and I can nod politely and even agree with what you're saying. But you haven't made it matter to me. That means that apologetics has to go out, not has to include, but also go beyond the realm of just giving them the facts, because they can sit there and say, great, those facts might be true, and I don't care. So we have more work to do now than ever, I think. It's not just presenting a good case for the facts. We have to present a good case for why truth matters. And that's a whole level of additional effort, but I do think it's worth it, and I do think it's doable.
One of the most compelling things I find with respect to you is not only the wisdom that you have provided through your lectures and your books, through what you're doing in the area of apologetics, but what I find so compelling is the manner in which you communicate. You can say all the right things, you can win the arguments, but in doing that, you're not necessarily winning the person. So people care not just about what you say, but how you say what you say.
Indeed. And you know, again, one of the things that I really appreciate about your ministry, Hank, is that I remember before I even became a Christian, I was listening to your show on the radio, and I was driving home and listening to the call-ins. And a couple of times Muslims would call in, or non-Christians would call in, and sometimes they would be pretty hard to handle, I would say, in a social context. And you responded with grace and a steady hand on truth, uncompromising but also compassionate. And I've heard so many people who were on your show, guests, where I'd heard this, and I'd seen that, and then also engaging with people. I remember thinking, if I ever do this, if I ever become a Christian, I hope that I answer questions or answer people that way. And I take it from the Apostle Paul's words, where he says in Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, when he says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time, letting your speech always be gracious, though seasoned with salt, so you may know how to answer, some versions say anyone or everyone, but in the one that I love, the way it's put is that you may know how to answer each person. Paul is saying right there, we are not in the question-answering business. None of us are, even those of us who answer questions for a living like you and me. We are not, and we recognize this, not in the question-answering business, because questions don't need answers, but people need answers. And that's why the Apostle Paul, I think under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, wrote so beautifully, so you may know how you ought to answer each person, not each question. I've tried my hardest to put myself in the shoes as someone who was not a Christian before, who heard answers that were compelling, not only to my mind, but also my heart. And so they affirm my quest, because my quest for truth, even sometimes as blind as it was or misguided, is a legitimate quest, no matter my methodologies. They said, you're looking for the truth? I can offer it to you. We can disagree disagreeably or agreeably with the pick which one. And they picked agreeably. And it wasn't just a polite conversation. The trick to me is, how do you offer the gospel in a way that makes good people wish it were true? And I take that, of course, from Blaise Pascal when he says that statement, that men despise religion because they fear that it may be true. And the trick is to show that religion is not contrary to reason but worthy of reverence and respect. Make it attractive. Make good people wish it were true, and then show them that it is. I've tried my hardest to do that, and I've emulated wonderful people who I think have gone before me who have done the same thing. And I think to myself, if I was a non-Christian sitting in this audience, would I be challenged by the facts presented, but also affirmed by the manner in which it was presented?
Yeah, beautifully said. Talk a little bit about your friend Nabil Qureshi. You know, so often someone has a tremendous impact, as he did. He, like you, converted from Islam to Christianity. He wrote some incredible books. He died, and we can all too quickly forget about the significance that he had. And one of those things was what we were just talking about. He had a manner about him that was so kind and gracious and giving. And as a result of that, he made a tremendous difference in the lives of people all over the world.
He did indeed. And, you know, it's hard to believe that coming in the fall, it'll be a year since he's been gone, taken so young and so early. And I think to myself, my goodness, someone who's reached his mid-30s has had such an impact in such a grand way, not just in the field of apologetics and evangelism to Muslims, but in other places as well. And I think you're right, it is that mannerism. You read his books, they're full of wonderful information, but lovingly given. And there have been other books written by wonderful people who have done academic and scholarly stuff on the same exact subjects that he had done, yet his had an impact because of the personal nature of it. I think that if you look at someone like a Nabil and you say, why is it that he could stand up to somebody who comes at him hammer and tongs with really tough objections and harshly worded statements, and then he comes back by saying, look, here's the answers, but I'm not going to mock you in response. I think it's because he puts himself in their shoes once again and says, what would have reached me? What would have gotten to me? Maybe he even puts his dad or his mom in that position of someone who's an interlocutor, who's asking him a question and says, would I be willing to say this to my sister or my mother in this way if it was harsh and cruel and mean, or even forthright but makes them feel stupid when they walk away? Or would I want them to feel like, boy, I want to listen more? And he did that so well, so often, and I was just grateful to have had an opportunity to be his friend both before, during, and at the close of his ministry.
When I wrote the book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, you reviewed the book before it was released to the public, and I am indebted to you for the insights that you gave me. I don't want to say that publicly.
Well, thank you, Hank. And it was, as I expressed to you before, it was an honor to even be a part of that. The Lord works in these amazing ways where there I was. In fact, I had called into your show years and years and years ago. I'd even used sort of a nickname that I had to mask my name in case anybody was listening. And I asked you a question, and I had said something along these lines. I had something like, well, Mr. Hanegraaff, I'm in the middle of, I'm sort of what you would call between religions, Islam and Christianity. He said, no, you're not. You're actually between a religion and a relationship and with the living God. And then you began to answer a question I had about the Trinity. How poetic is it that when I wasn't even a Christian, you were a part of that journey, and then I get an email asking if I would review a book like that, and just honored to be a part of it, and thank you for writing it.
Oh, you got it. You talk about in your book, again, I want to really focus in on this book, you talk about soft and hard modes of post-truth. Can you help people understand what you're driving at there?
Sure, absolutely. So if we look at the definition of post-truth being this idea of elevating feelings and preferences over facts and truth, then we can see that there are two modes. The first mode, the hard mode actually, is that if you're post-truth, where you elevate feelings and preferences over truth, then we feel the incentive to lie, to out and out misstate certain facts or suppress certain facts because our agenda, whether it's noble or ignoble, we feel like it's more important than the minutiae of the facts of the truth. Hmm. So if we have like an environmentalist agenda or even a pro-life agenda, whatever it is, a post-truth culture will, in the hard version of it, say, well, I'm not going to tell the truth about a couple of things because my agenda is so noble that I'm willing to sort of slaughter the truth for the sake of a higher purpose. That's sort of the hard version of it, where we can feel like we can lie and have a license to lie in order to get an agenda across. The soft version, ironically, is actually harder to deal with because it just subordinates truth to preferences. So if I have a specific agenda, whether it's political or social, and I think that the truth is inconvenient, I don't lie about it. I just won't talk about it, or I'll denigrate it as, well, that's only provincial or that's only provisional. We're going to come to more facts later on, or don't bother me with the facts right now. I have my preferences to think of. So the hard version involves out-and-out lies. I think the soft version involves spin or ignoring the truth altogether.
We'll pick up Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author Abdu Murray in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in the battle for life and truth. And as thanks for your gift, receive a copy of Abdu Murray's book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. There is a mysterious resonance among the structure of the material world, the abstract world of mathematics, and the human mind. This three-part harmony has major implications for the contemporary debate between naturalism and theism. The sciences alone, however, are insufficient to illuminate this enigma. Other topics include The Handmaid's Tale, Human Dignity and Hope. Slaughterhouse-Five is a tool for Christian self-examination. Redeeming Princess Culture, Five Apologetics Lessons from the Writings of Martin Luther King Jr., and much, much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
The history of Islam is one of wanton carnage and horrific oppression, and it has been whitewashed beyond recognition by our politically correct elites. According to credible sources, 120 million Africans, 80 million Hindus, 60 million Christians, 10 million Buddhists have been slaughtered in the name of Islam. And that doesn't include the millions of Muslims killed by other Muslims. Islam is the only significant religious system in the history of the human race with a socio-political structure of laws that mandate violence against the infidel. Read Hank Hanegraaff's stunning book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. Receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership when you call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. Supporting the work of the Christian Research Institute is now as easy as sending a text message. Here's how you can help by texting your gift directly to CRI. To make a one-time gift to help equip fellow believers through the ongoing work of CRI, text TRUTH in all capital letters to 41444. That's TRUTH to 41444. To become a CRI support team member and make a difference on a regular basis, text STANDING in all capital letters to 91999. Again, that is STANDING to 91999. We do what we do here at CRI because life and truth matter. And all of our outreaches are made possible by people like you standing shoulder to shoulder with us to make a difference for now and for eternity. God bless you. There is no greater need in our post-truth culture of confusion than the clarification of truth, what truth is, how one can know truth, and most importantly, why we must submit our personal preferences to truth, no matter the cost. Be sure to read Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World by Abdu Murray. To receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. Well, let's again pick up Hank Hanegraaff and author Abdu Murray in their conversation on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
You know, Oz Guinness, in a book called Time for Truth, He talked about creative storytelling and how it's pandemic in the broader culture and how it runs the gamut from NBC television stage report on the exploding General Motors trucks and then later on planted detonations. And he talked about Nora McCorvey's, she was Jane Roe, of course, a fabricated story of rape encouraged by pro-abortion leaders, so instrumental in the U.S. Supreme Court's 1973 decision, Roe v. Wade. And what's interesting about this is the truth-twisting tactics were inevitably justified by the larger truth. And this was spoken of by filmmaker Oliver Stone. He used it in defending the facts in one of his films. And he said, even if I'm totally wrong, I am still right. I am essentially right because I'm depicting the evil with a capital E.
And that's, boy, you know, you use those examples, and it's so true that people, ironically, right, it's so true that people will justify because they're ultimately right or essentially right, which, of course, if you're half right, then you're all wrong in some of these senses, and people don't necessarily realize that. But again, that goes back to the preferences issue. And I've said this in the book, and I think it's true of us. This is a human nature issue. I don't think we're going to solve it politically. I don't think we're going to solve it socially. I think we have to solve it spiritually, which is ultimately why I think a book like this is important to add to the conversation, because I fundamentally believe that though we are wonderfully created in God's image, there's something very, very seriously wrong with us that doesn't require us to get on the moral treadmill, but requires us to get a heart transplant. This started with our first parents. I mean, when you think about Adam and Eve, and you think about how post-truth they actually were, they lived with this statement from God, do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And who knows how long they lived perfectly fine with that truth. And they walked and talked with truth incarnate in the garden. God walked with them in the cool of the day, as Genesis says. And yet Satan comes along, and he misquotes God, and they misquote God back to him. And he says, God knows you won't die, but you'll be like him. That's a half-truth, is that they will know good and evil, but they're not equipped to know good and evil and to be able to deal with it. So they suddenly Eve cares about this fruit, and it becomes desirous to her for eating. And Adam, of course, follows suit. Why? I think because, without playing too much of armchair psychologist, her preferences to be God mattered more than the truth that her purpose was to be with God. And I think that we're living in the aftermath of that. So the seed of a post-truth culture was planted in that garden, and it's blossomed into the full-grown tree it is today, where people like Oliver Stone can make rationalizations about misstating facts to get at an essential truth, which is just one way of saying, look, I misstated the facts because I have an agenda and I want to convince you of it.
But you're not alleviating anybody of this problem. You're saying this is a virus, and this virus can affect you and I. It can affect politicians and pastors and philosophers and parents. It can affect scientists. So no one is above this. So it's not as though you and I are having this discussion. We've got it figured out. We're not susceptible to this virus. We are, and we have to be vigilant.
We do indeed, and in fact, I wanted to dedicate at least one chapter of the book to this very fact of self-reflection. The book is intended for both Christians and non-Christians alike, and I hope I've been fair with all positions so that non-Christians will read it and say he wasn't, you know, putting up a straw man, which is why chapter two of the book is specifically about confusion in the church and the seductions of a post-truth mindset. The church is susceptible on two fronts, I think. One, Christians are susceptible to a post-truth culture of confusion because they want to be liked, and the second one is because they want to vilify enemies. And I think both are unbalanced and can lead to similar problems. So one, if we take a desire to be liked, we'll take passages like probably the most oft misinterpreted passage of Scripture or misquoted or failed the whole context of judge not that ye be not judged. So Christians aren't supposed to be judgmental. Of course, they don't read the whole thing. And so Christians, in an effort to be liked, won't judge anybody's moral actions. as opposed to what Jesus says, is that when you judge, judge correctly, because you're supposed to judge non-hypocritically. But you are to judge, but judge in a non-hypocritical manner. But Christians misinterpret it and so contribute to the culture of confusion by sort of becoming susceptible to this idea that, well, anybody's personal choices are somehow valid. That's an utterly unbiblical thing to say. But we do it because we want to be liked. But the second thing, the pendular swing the other way, is just as dangerous, is where we don't really care if we're liked, but we actually want to make sure our enemies are liked less than we are. And we start to vilify people and spread untruths. And the example I give is after the Obergefell decision, through which the Supreme Court of the United States legalized same-sex marriage across the country. After that happened in 2015, I saw things on my news feeds and my social media, but also emails I got from people about a story. And the story was that a gay activist had sued in federal court two Christian publishers to ban the Bible as hate speech and using the Obergefell decision as the justification for that. It took me 3 minutes, all of 3 minutes, to find out through a little bit of research that none of that's true. That yes, a homosexual man actually had sued two Christian publishers in federal court, but he didn't sue to ban the Bible. He sued for damages, claiming that the publishers mistranslated the Bible to be non-gay affirming, and he was emotionally hurt by that. And he didn't file it after the Obergefell decision. He filed it 7 years before the Obergefell decision, and it was dismissed as frivolous. I happen to actually know the judge who dismissed that case. So it was Christians, unfortunately, or at least those who would claim to be Christians, who had propagated this story in an effort to make their enemies look as bad as possible. Because the agenda, as noble as it might be, to safeguard the sacredness of marriage, somehow was more important than the propagation of truth. And that's one example, and there are others, unfortunately, of how Christians have succumbed to a post-truth culture. And we need to be vigilant of it, ever vigilant of it, because they will never believe the message if they never believe the messenger.
So you're an apologist and one par excellence, but a couple of things I want to do here is, one, ask you to define apologetics. It might seem sophomoric, but a lot of people hear that term. They're still tripped up by it. But the other thing I want to get at is the implications of post-truth respecting the task of someone who is an apologist. And I would say that everyone who is a Christian is an apologist. You're either a good apologist or a bad apologist, but you are an apologist. You're called to be an apologist.
Indeed, indeed. And we need them now more than ever. So if I were to take a look at a definition of apologetics and I was to take two looks at it, or two aspects from it. Obviously, 1 Peter 3:15 being sort of one of the linchpin verses of Scripture where we're all called to be apologists, and in fact, I would even say in a post-truth culture where it's becoming harder and harder to become a Christian, Peter's words in 1 Peter are more applicable in one sense than ever before, or at least more readily applicable in terms of its apparentness, because he was writing in the context of it being difficult to be a Christian. He was talking about when people look at you and they scoff you and they mistreat you because of being a Christian, set apart Christ as Lord in your heart, always being prepared to provide a defense for the faith you have and all these things. That word, of course, for defense is apologia, and that defines what it means to be a Christian in terms of offering the hope of the gospel. But what I love about his phrase is something that we often don't talk about too much when he says, offering the reason for the hope you have to anyone who asks, but do this with gentleness and with respect. So that part, to anyone who asks, that goes back to that whole thing about everyone's called to be an apologist. Because the question becomes, do you have a PhD in something? Or do you do it professionally? Are you well-read in every aspect of every philosophical argument? The answer to almost all these things for most of us is no. But you are called to give a reason, a defense, for the hope you have to anyone who asks, which means, as a Christian, among other things, about being intellectually prepared to respond to the challenges, you're also called, as an apologist, to live a life of hope, such that someone says, what is it with you? Why do you have hope in a world that doesn't want you to have any or doesn't give you any good reasons to have any? And so being apologist is not just about defending the Christian faith intellectually, but it's about living the Christian faith in a way that makes people who are outside the fold say, whatever you have, I want, but I want to make sure it's also true. So I think that's a fundamental part of what it means to be an apologist. And it goes right to the point of your question, is that everyone's an apologist. You're either a good one or a bad one. And I think bad ones can include the most prepared. I mean, I'll say this. I remember when I was considering coming to the Christian faith, I remember listening to the radio, and there was somebody on the radio. I won't name the person, but they were talking about a certain group of people who weren't Christians in the most derogatory and mean-spirited ways. And this person clearly knew what they were talking about in terms of the foundations for the Christian faith. And they said it in such a way that I actually had to turn the radio off. And I was with somebody then who was close to me and still is to this day, who was a Christian. And I said, are you telling me that's your faith? And that person had to spend an hour and a half explaining how it wasn't. Here's somebody on the radio who was so good with the facts that backed up the faith, but so bankrupt in their ability to express it that in one sense, yeah, you're as knowledgeable as the next person, but you're a bad apologist because you don't provide a reason for the hope you have. I would never ask that person in a personal conversation, why are you a Christian? But I know plenty of people who have not even half the knowledge that person has, but has some level of knowledge. Why are you a Christian? Because they make me want to know why they have that faith.
You've already alluded to this, but I want you to expand on it. You know, Peter says we have to do it with gentleness and with respect, with meekness and with reverence. And then he says, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. I love that. I mean, first, the meekness and the reverence, the gentleness, the respect. But I also love the fact that Peter's making clear that people will speak out maliciously against you, but you got to keep a clear conscience. That's your job.
Absolutely. And I think that that goes right into this idea of the post-truth culture. If you speak, you can even speak something that you think might be true or possibly true or, you know, a half-baked truth or maybe I'm not even sure, and you do it in a really winsome way. But you're eventually going to be, it's almost like selling snake oil. You can do it really nicely with a meekness and a mildness, but that clear conscience part really does come down to it, is that have you respected the person as someone who's made in God's image, no matter how much they disagree with you, they still are made in God's image, and have you respected the truth?
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with author and Christian apologist Abdu Murray. Our mission at the Christian Research Institute is to equip Christians to think and live Christianly. In appreciation for your gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, Hank Hanegraaff would like to send you a copy of Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World by Abdu Murray. Just call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271, or simply visit online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The history of Islam is one of wanton carnage and horrific oppression, and it has been whitewashed beyond recognition by our politically correct elites. According to credible sources, 120 million Africans, 80 million Hindus, 60 million Christians, 10 million Buddhists have been slaughtered in the name of Islam. And that doesn't include the millions of Muslims killed by other Muslims. Islam is the only significant religious system in the history of the human race with a socio-political structure of laws that mandate violence against the infidel. Read Hank Hanegraaff's stunning book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. Receive your copy as our appreciation for your financial partnership when you call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Many feminists see the warped value system portrayed in Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale as a reflection of Christian and social conservative ideologies. In reality, the dominant secular worldview, with its idolization of sexual freedom and rejection of intrinsic human dignity, fosters in the actual world the very oppression seen in the series. Other topics include how the structure and comprehensibility of the universe reveal a mindful maker, five apologetics lessons from the writings of Martin Luther King Jr., kindergartners need apologetics too, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today at the new discounted rate by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.